Have you ever like tried to describe a really profound dream to a friend and you just realize that language completely fails you?
Oh yeah, constantly.
Right, you're grasping at words and they just sound incredibly hollow compared to what you actually felt in the dream.
Yeah, the words just kind of fall flat.
Exactly. And for decades, I mean, that is exactly how people talked about the peak psychedelic experience. It was considered completely ineffable, just, untouchable.
Permanently beyond the reach of human language, basically.
Right. So today we are taking a deep dive into the literal neuroscience of, well, losing yourself. We're guiding this whole conversation around a fascinating article from the OTW Journal. It's titled Ego Dissolution: The Neuroscience of Losing Yourself.
Which is such a brilliant piece of literature.
It really is. And just to be super clear right up front, and this is echoing the journal's own disclaimer, by the way, our mission today is to take a completely impartial look at the neuroscience here.
Right, just the facts.
Exactly. This is an educational exploration of what clinical research reveals about brain organization. It is, not a medical recommendation. We are certainly not endorsing taking any substances. We're just following the science to see what it tells us about how the brain constructs this thing we call me.
And the science here really starts to get concrete around 2016, because for the longest time, the scientific community hit a massive barrier with this.
Because it's so subjective.
Right. If you ask people what a strong psychedelic feels like, once you get past the obvious stuff, like visual changes or geometric pattern,
Barbie colors and all that.
yeah, exactly, you inevitably arrive at this structurally impossible sentence, which is, I stopped being me.
Which is such a wild concept to even try to put into words.
It is. It isn't that the lights go out. The person isn't unconscious. It's something much stranger. The owner of the experience simply dissolves while the experience itself just continues on completely without one. So for most of the 20th century, this was the untouchable center of the psychedelic state. But then researchers made this really brilliant pivot. They stopped trying to philosophically explain the ineffable, and instead they figured out how to measure it.
How to turn poetry into hard data.
Exactly. And the breakthrough on that front came from the work of Matthew Noor and his colleagues. This was at Imperial College London.
Okay.
They recognized that, if you want to study a highly subjective experience scientifically, you need a standardized ruler. You have to have a metric. So they created what they called the Ego Dissolution Inventory, or the EDI.
The EDI.
Yeah, it's an 8-item scale. And they painstakingly validated this across, I think it was more than 1,800 reported drug experiences.
That is a massive sample size.
It's huge.
Yeah.
And it essentially asks people to rate statements on a spectrum. Statements like, I experienced a dissolution of myself or ego, or I felt at one with the universe.
Okay, I have to pause and push back on this just slightly because we're talking about building a thermometer for the human soul, basically.
I mean, that's one way to put it.
But doesn't reducing this profound, life-altering sense of universal unity to like an 8-item questionnaire from 1 to 10, doesn't that sort of ruin the magic of the experience? I mean, how can ticking a box on a survey actually capture the feeling of merging with the cosmos?
Right. It sounds incredibly reductive when you frame it like that. I totally get it. But think about what that thermometer actually unlocked for the scientific community.
Okay.
Having a standardized ruler to measure the loss of self is precisely what allowed scientists to finally go looking for where this phenomenon lives in the physical brain.
Ah, so it gives them a target.
Exactly. The EDI proved that ego dissolution isn't just, some symptom of generic intoxication.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen when you just drink way too much alcohol or take a heavy sedative. The responses across all those 1,800 experiences, they collapsed onto a single coherent psychological dimension.
Yeah. Wait, really? So it's a distinct, measurable state of being. It's not just someone being really messed up.
Yes, it is highly specific. And crucially, this dimension scales directly with the subjective intensity of the psychedelic experience. The higher the dose, the higher the score. It even beautifully captures its mirror image at the opposite pole of the spectrum.
What's the mirror image of losing your ego?
Ego inflation.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that feeling of being overly important or entirely disconnected from others,
Yeah.
which happens with, completely different substances like cocaine or alcohol.
Yeah.
So once you turn the ineffable into a reliable number, you can finally put someone inside an fMRI scanner, track those numbers, and literally see what the blood flow and the brain activity are actually doing when someone reports that their sense of self is vanishing.
Okay, that makes total sense. So Nir gave us a ruler, but a ruler is pretty useless if you don't know where to point it,
Right.
right? So where in the physical brain were they even looking for this vanishing self? Like, where do you point the scanner to find the eye?
So the answer to that centers on something called the default mode network, or the DMN.
The DMN.
Yeah, this is a network of highly active hubs, and they're located deep within the midline of the brain. What is really unique about the DMN is, well, it's when it decides to activate.
When is it active?
It lights up most intensely when you are doing absolutely nothing in particular.
Wait, nothing?
Yeah, when you're staring out a window, mind wandering, or, you know, when you're remembering an argument you had yesterday, or when you're planning what you're going to say in the meeting tomorrow, it is constantly narrating yourself to yourself.
Wait, let me make sure I'm grasping this. The me part of my brain is the machinery that's running when I'm just, like, standing in line at the grocery store staring blankly at the gum rack?
That is the absolute perfect way to think about it, yes.
That is wild.
The DMN is essentially the brain's self-modeling machinery. It is the biological system that stitches all of your scattered, momentary experiences into a single, continuous person over time. It gives you the feeling that the you who woke up this morning is the exact same you who went to sleep last night.
Wow. Okay, so what happens to this narrator network when someone actually takes a psychedelic?
Well, in the first ever functional MRI study of the psychedelic state, this was conducted by Robin Carhart-Harris and his colleagues back in 2012, they gave people psilocybin.
Psilocybin being the active compound in magic mushrooms.
Exactly. Now, going in, they fully expected the brain's activity to just spike, like light up across the board, given how visually and emotionally intense a trip is.
Right. You'd think the brain is in overdrive.
But they saw the exact opposite.
Really?
They observed a massive drop in blood flow and activity, and that drop was concentrated almost entirely in these DMN hubs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And the most critical finding from that study was that the size of that drop in activity perfectly tracked the reported intensity of ego dissolution. So the less blood flow to the DMN, the less self the person felt.
Okay, let me see if I can wrap my head around this with an analogy for you listening. Think of the default mode network as the director of the movie of your life.
I like that.
This director is constantly organizing the scenes, making sure the main character you is front and center, maintaining the continuity of the plot from yesterday to today.
Right.
But if you give the brain psilocybin and that director suddenly walks off the set, wait, the camera crew doesn't just pack up and go home, do they? Like, the movie doesn't just go black.
No, not at all. The crew doesn't pack up. What happens is the crew members stop listening to the director and they start talking directly to each other.
Oh, interesting.
And later work really sharpened this picture even further. In 2015, Lebedev and his colleagues conducted a study, and it has this wonderfully poetic title, Finding the Self by Losing the Self.
I love that.
They found that ego dissolution didn't just correlate with a drop in overall blood flow. It specifically correlated with the decoupling of the key hubs within this network.
Meaning they stopped talking to each other.
Exactly. When the highly active hubs in the midline of the brain stopped communicating, when the network's overall integrity just completely fell apart, people reported much higher spikes in ego dissolution.
So my identity isn't like a physical hard drive located in a specific fold of my brain. It's just the act of these regions talking to each other.
Yes. It emphasizes a monumental paradigm shift in how we understand consciousness itself.
How so?
Because the self is not a physical thing sitting in a specific place in your skull. It is an active pattern of connection. If you loosen that pattern, the self loosens right along with it.
But okay, if the internal narrator shuts up and the director walks off the set, what is actually going on in the brain? Because our source material makes it very clear that the lights are very much still on.
Very much on.
So what happens when that self network goes quiet? Does the brain just descend into pure chaos?
Far from it. Actually, this is where the science gets truly beautiful. This leads us to a fascinating study conducted by Tagliazuki and his colleagues in 2016. They mapped the brain under the influence of LSD.
Okay, what did they find?
They discovered that as the self network, the DMN, goes quiet, the global connectivity of the brain as a whole surges entirely out of its normal bounds.
And of its normal bounds, like in what way?
Well, normally, your brain has a very tidy, highly modular organization. It operates on what neuroscientists call a rich club principle.
A rich club?
Yeah. Certain high-level association areas only really talk to each other and then mostly ignore the rest of the brain to stay efficient. It's a very compartmentalized system.
Mm-hmm.
But under LSD, that strict modular organization breaks down completely, regions of the brain that usually keep strictly to their own lanes suddenly start cross-communicating.
Wow.
The brain becomes much more uniformly interconnected.
Yep.
And again, the degree of this new massive overconnection directly correlated with the participant scores on the ego dissolution inventory.
Okay, so think of it like a massive corporate office building. Normally, everyone is in their own little cubicle, right? The accounting department only talks to accounting. The marketing team only talks to marketing.
Right, right.
They send a few memos back and forth, but they mostly stay in their lanes. And then someone comes in, completely tears down all the cubicle walls, and suddenly every single department in the entire building is just brainstorming together in one giant room.
That is exactly it. They are brainstorming together, sharing information that usually never crosses paths.
That is incredible.
It is. Things like synesthesia, where people report seeing sounds or tasting colors, that is a direct result of this kind of crosstalk.
Because the visual and auditory departments are suddenly having a meeting together.
Exactly. And here's the real aha moment from the Tagliazuki study, what the article beautifully calls anatomical poetry.
Oh, what is that?
When they looked at the specific cortical areas that lit up with all this new surging connectivity, those areas perfectly overlapped with a map of the brain's 5-HT2A receptors.
And those 5-HT2A receptors are important because, remind me.
Because those receptors are the exact docking sites where the psychedelic molecule physically binds to the brain.
Are you serious?
Yes. The drug loosens the rigid boundaries of the self in the exact same physical locations where it chemically attaches to the brain tissue.
That really is anatomical poetry.
If we step back and connect this to the bigger picture, it tells us something profound about the mechanism of ego dissolution. It is not a deletion of consciousness. You aren't losing anything. It is a temporary, radical reorganization. The self model simply relaxes its grip, and the brain briefly becomes a single, hyper-connected whole.
Wow.
The sensation isn't that you lose the world. The sensation is that you merge with it.
You merge with it. That completely flips the script on what it means to lose yourself. It's not a disappearance at all. It's an expansion.
Exactly.
But this begs a really practical question. Understanding this hyper-connectivity, you know, the cubicle walls coming down, that is all fascinating. But it leads us directly to the why.
The clinical application.
Right. Why does this biological reorganization, this temporary loss of the self, actually heal people? Because the source article highlights that the depth of this ego dissolution strongly predicts how much an experience actually heals someone in clinical trials.
Yeah, to understand that healing mechanism, we really have to look at the leading theoretical model in the field right now. It's called the RBS framework.
RBS, like the puzzle.
Spelled the same way, yeah. It stands for Relaxed Beliefs Under Psychedelics. This was proposed by Carhart Harris and Carl Friston in 2019. The core idea relies on understanding what the default mode network is doing when it's functioning normally.
Okay, so when it's narrating.
Right. We said earlier it narrates your life, but it does more than that. It enforces your highest level priors.
Priors. What do you mean by priors? Like biases or assumptions?
Broadly, yes. Yeah. Deep-seated, rigid beliefs through which you subconsciously filter all of reality. Your brain is a prediction machine, and priors are the foundational stories you tell yourself about yourself and the world so you know what to expect.
Okay, can you give an example of that?
Sure. On a daily level, a prior might be your stubborn assumption that a friend who hasn't texted back is mad at you.
Right, we all do that.
But on a deeper level, these are stories like, I am worthless, or the world is fundamentally dangerous, or this physical or emotional pain is permanent.
So bringing this right down to the ground for you listening, if you think about severe mental health conditions, things like treatment-resistant depression, addiction, or obsessive-compulsive disorder, we normally talk about them as chemical imbalances, right?
Historically, yes.
But this RBS framework suggests we can also look at them as disorders of an overcertain self. Your brain has formed a model of reality that is clenched way too tightly around a negative story.
Yes, exactly. The priors have become too precise. The brain has too much biological confidence in a negative belief, making it totally inflexible. And what psychedelics do biologically is reduce the precision, that biological confidence, with which the brain holds on to those priors.
Because of the 5-HT2A receptors.
Precisely. The chemical action at those receptors forces the rigid self model to relax its grip. And when that happens, ego dissolution is essentially the subjective feeling of that clenched fist finally releasing.
It makes me think of a blacksmith working with metal.
Oh, I like this.
If you have a piece of iron that has been bent completely out of shape, representing these rigid, entrenched negative beliefs, you can't just bend it back with your bare hands, right?
It's too rigid.
It's too stiff. It will just snap. You have to put it into the fire. You have to heat it up and melt down that rigid structure just enough so that the metal becomes malleable again. And only then can you take a hammer and forge it into a new, healthier shape.
That's a brilliant analogy.
Yeah.
And psychedelics are essentially the heat in that scenario. They induce a state of profound neuroplasticity. For a few hours, the entrenched model of the self is held loosely enough that it can actually be revised.
So it really is like a reset.
It's the closest thing neuroscience has found to a literal factory reset for the human mind. The brain sets down the incredibly heavy, rigid story of you, experiences the reality of being connected to a larger whole, and then gets the chance to pick the story back up differently when the drug wears off.
And that's why the dissolution is so important for healing.
Exactly. The intensity of the peak dissolution predicts lasting improvement, because a complete meltdown of those priors gives the brain the maximum amount of room to rebuild.
Okay, but if melting down this self is the ultimate key to healing, we absolutely have to talk about the shadow side of this.
We do.
Why is ego dissolution also notoriously terrifying for some people? Like, if it's this beautiful merging with the universe and a chance to factory reset, why do people have such deeply traumatic bad trips? Our source material naturally shifts to this, and it feels, you know, crucial to address the risks here.
It is entirely crucial to address. Because while researchers and philosophers use terms like merging with the universe, the raw, lived reality of the experience can be drastically different depending on the individual. The core danger lies in how the human mind interprets what is happening to it.
Okay.
The ego, your constructed sense of self, is constantly fighting for its own survival. Its whole job is to keep you separate and safe. So when the biological structures supporting that self begin to dissolve, the mind naturally interprets that literal loss of self as actual death.
Because to the brain's internal narrator, if the story ends, that is death. It doesn't know the difference between ego death and physical death.
It doesn't. Now, physically, the state itself is not neurotoxic. Your body is perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
But psychologically, experiencing the sensation of dying while entirely unprepared or, you know, in a chaotic, unsafe setting can instantly flip the experience from feeling liberating to feeling unimaginably terrifying.
Which makes total sense.
This is why we see such a massive emphasis on context in all of the clinical research. Ego dissolution is strongly dose-dependent, but more importantly, it is context-dependent. The entire foundation of clinical psychedelic work relies on preparation, a safe container, and trusted guides. It's what researchers refer to as set and setting.
I really want to push back on the chemistry here for a second, though, because think about it logically. If I take a high dose in a pristine, supportive clinical setting with two highly trained therapists, or I take that exact same high dose at a chaotic, loud music festival surrounded by strangers, the actual biological event in my brain is identical, right?
Yes.
The default mode network is dropping in blood flow. The global connectivity is surging out of bounds. The receptors are doing their exact thing. So is the environment you're in really as powerful as that raw chemistry in determining whether this is a healing factory reset or a deeply traumatic event?
This raises a fantastic question about the intersection of biology and psychology, and the answer is absolutely yes.
Really? Just the environment?
The raw chemical cascade is the same. The DMN will quiet down regardless of where you are. But how you experience that quieting down is entirely governed by your environment and your psychological preparation.
Okay, explain that.
If you were in a clinical setting and you've spent weeks preparing with a therapist, when the self starts to dissolve, you feel safe enough to surrender to it. You let the blacksmith melt the metal, to use your analogy.
Right.
But if you were at a chaotic festival and you feel your core identity slipping away, your defense mechanisms will go into absolute overdrive. You will fight the dissolution, desperately clinging to your priors.
And fighting that is what causes the trauma.
Exactly. Fighting a biological certainty is what creates trauma. The environment dictates the psychological friction. The dissolution itself isn't the danger. Facing it unprepared and violently fighting it is where the danger lies.
That makes total sense when you frame it around friction. It's the difference between peacefully floating down a rushing river and violently trying to swim upstream against it.
Perfect analogy, yes.
The river is moving at the exact same speed either way, but your reaction determines whether you drown or travel somewhere new.
When met with support and surrender, it's a profound opportunity for rewiring the brain. When met with resistance and chaos, the exact same biological event can be incredibly destabilizing.
Wow. Okay, we have covered some truly mind-bending territory today. Let's do a quick recap of the incredible journey of this deep dive.
Sounds good.
So we started with the researchers who boldly built a ruler to measure the ineffable, the ego dissolution inventory, which proved this is a real scalable phenomenon and not just, intoxication.
Right.
That ruler allowed neuroscientists to find the self hiding in the default mode network's connectivity pattern. Then we watch what happens when that narrator network drops offline and the brain's global connectivity floods open into this hyperconnected state of
The
unity.
cubicle walls coming down.
Exactly. And finally, we explored the RBS model, learning how relaxing an overcertain, rigid self offers this profound yet potentially terrifying chance to heal.
And stepping back, I think it's deeply important to reflect on why this matters to you, the listener, right now. Even if you never intend to encounter a psychedelic substance in your life,
Absolutely.
the neuroscience of ego dissolution reveals a fundamental, beautiful truth about human consciousness. The continuous, unbroken I that you feel right now, this specific identity you woke up with this morning, it is not a fixed, immutable object trapped in your head.
It's not a hard drive.
It is a dynamic pattern of neural connections. It's an active process. And because it is a pattern, it is capable of being reorganized. You are not as permanently stuck in your stories as you might feel.
That is a remarkably hopeful takeaway, this idea that we are constantly constructing ourselves and therefore we can reconstruct ourselves. But as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final lingering thought, something from the source material that has been honestly chewing at the back of my mind all day.
Oh, what is it?
The article notes that the default mode network is the machinery stitching scattered moments into a continuous person over time. If your deeply felt sense of being an unbroken, continuous self, if the I is really just an adjustable setting of brain connectivity, if the ego is just a story that the brain is constantly telling itself, who or what is the one actually listening to the story?